This is a crusade. This is a holy war against the deep state.
Where are the dictators? Where are the strong men?
Donald Trump is our instrument for retribution.
I'm going to fight for Christians. I'm going to fight for white people.
They have the Great Reset. We have the Great Awakening.
And why shouldn't I root for Russia?
Because I am.
I want to see these people go through misery because of their grooming against our children.
After the assailant entered the home asking, "Where's Nancy? Where's Nancy?" Those are the very same words used by the mob when they stormed the United States Capitol.
I did nothing wrong.
Welcome to the Did Nothing Wrong podcast, where we cut through the noise and help you make sense of the chaotic information space around us. I'm Griff Somke. Lauren Manning is a former white nationalist skinhead who now works with a group called Life After Hate to help and support people who are ready to leave extremism behind. She's the co-author of a book called Walking Away from Hate about her time in the movement and her journey out of it. I'm thrilled to have her on the podcast today. Stick around. Lauren, welcome to Did Nothing Wrong.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Your book begins with the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. You had been out of the movement yourself for a few years at that point, but the events of that day drove you to do something more. What went through your mind when you started hearing the reports of the violence?
So I actually didn't get it from a news source originally. I kind of had my head buried in the sand at the time. I was just ignoring everything media, everything news, just because I'm like, you know what? I need to work on myself for a couple of years. And I mean, completely understandable, right?
Sure.
So I was working in scaffolding at the time, and I went to work one day, and 7 o'clock in the friggin' morning, one of my coworkers is on one of his little political rants. So he said, "Hey, did you guys hear about that psychopath down in Charlottesville, Virginia? Guess what he did?" And as soon as I heard the words, it was a far right rally.
Oh boy.
I'm like, oh fuck. So I went and looked it up later that day when I got home, and like, it was all right in front of me. So I said, you know, I did expect it to come to something like this. I just didn't think it would be that soon. I'm not really sure why I thought that. But ultimately, I'm like, okay, well, I still did contribute to something like this, even though I've been out for a couple of years and like not having anything to do with it. I was still there.
Right.
So I had seen a bunch of stuff all across Facebook, just because I had all new friends at this point. So several of my friends, and actually one of my family members, one of my cousins specifically, they were posting stuff like, once a Nazi, always a Nazi. The only good Nazi is a dead Nazi.
Right.
So I actually messaged one of them and I said, well, you know my history. Like, so where do I stand in that statement? And she goes, oh, no, you're different. So I said, well, I mean, how?
Yeah.
So I said, listen, I mean, I'm all for consequences for someone's actions. There is obviously a such thing as self-accountability. It's just killing them might not be such a wonderful idea.
It's a little hard to be accountable after that, you know, once you're dead.
Exactly.
So you got into this about, by the timeline of the book, you were about 13, I think, 14 when you started looking into this stuff. Am I right?
So 13 or 14 is when high school started, and that's when things just completely went downhill for me. Right. I was getting teased at school because I was a little bit heavier than most of the other girls there.
Right.
Like I wasn't terribly overweight. It's just, you know, it was enough to have me be noticed.
Anything different? Yeah. Any difference?
Yeah. High school is not the best place to learn how to socialize. And of course I see that as an adult now. And then jumping forward to when I was 16 is when my father passed away after a 9-year battle with leukemia.
Okay.
And a year after that, so I was 17, I was drinking every single day just to try to cope with everything going on. And I got a message over Facebook, actually, like when it was the media platform that everybody liked at the time.
Right, right.
This was in like 2007, I believe.
Yeah.
So it said, I was wondering if you are a National Socialist or just listen to National Socialist black metal. And I'm just sitting back in my chair like, what is this guy talking about? But I still wanted someone to chat with. So I said, I just listened to the music, hoping that was a good enough answer. And the conversations went from there. It started off with the anti-political correctness kind of stuff. And for me, having grown up in a conservative household, I could mostly get on board with some of what he was saying.
Right.
It's just, eventually it came to the constant dropping of the N-word and other racial slurs for other groups of people. So I was a little bit uncomfortable with it, but at the same time, I was also used to hearing it because my grandfather used to drop that stuff right in front of my brother and I as we were growing up.
You mentioned in the book that he was a pretty awful racist about this stuff.
Yeah, so a little bit about his history. He is British born, served in World War II, and then came over here, I believe, just after his time in the war.
Okay.
And obviously therapy not really being a thing at the time and, you know, trying to maintain like a sense of masculinity probably also came into play for him. So he just never sorted out his issues. And we've heard in later years from some of our relatives over in the UK saying, yeah, this type of attitude has been going on in our family for generations and generations, as has addiction, as has a bunch of other issues.
So you were kind of at least a little used to hearing the idea. Do you think the guy was testing you on Facebook that was asking you those questions and saying those words to see what you'd do?
I believe so. He never directly came out and told me that later on. We were friends for a couple of years, I would say, before he had taken off to go out west in Canada.
Right.
Because he was tired of Ontario, I suppose. So he never directly told me that, although there are definitely indications when I look back on it that I was being tested. So basically, it's conditional friendship at that point.
Right. Right. So you got to the point where you were friends with this guy. That was Donnie, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And you guys had made friends and you guys were talking, kicking ideas back and forth. And at that point, it seemed like he had found somebody he could, you know, convince to do a lot of this stuff, be his friend, to be part of his crew, as he put it. And it seems like he was getting a lot of his own sort of personal worth and validation from this. Like, the guy didn't have a whole lot going for him based on anything you said in the book. And if you looked at him objectively, you'd be like, this guy's a loser, period. This guy is just not amazing. But he's found a place where he can kind of be the man around a whole group of, you know, kind of younger, more impressionable people. Would you say that's accurate?
I would say that is 110% accurate. The way I kind of saw him even at the time when I was 17, I'm like, this guy's like the circus clown that you just keep around for your own sick, twisted entertainment. But I'm going to admit that I did enjoy that at the time. And this is also someone who never questioned my anger in any way, shape, or form. If anything, it was encouraged, but it's like, okay, we're going to like narrow down where you should be directing it to, is basically the message.
That's interesting that you bring that up about the anger. You've got a quote in the book where you say, quote, my attraction to the movement, I told him, wasn't so much about the ideology, but rather because it was a cause I could attach my anger to. And that kind of resonated because a lot of the people that you mentioned meeting in your movement days, they seem to be motivated by some kind of anger. And there isn't a whole lot of healthy ways for kids, or really adults for that matter, these days to release these feelings, this anger, in a healthy manner. What do you think would have helped you at that point? And how difficult do you think it would be to scale that so kids that need help here can get it?
Well, first off, what I should say is that anger is kind of like the outward emotion. There's typically another one behind it. So for me, it was grief. It was feeling lost. And I imagine very similar for other folks who have ever set foot into this movement or are currently in it. So it all depends on the person's life situation. And I really wish this form of therapy was around when I was that age. I'm not sure if it was or not, or I just didn't hear about it if it was. But I did EMDR, so eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, after I got out of the movement, and my anger toned down significantly.
Well, that's interesting.
And it's because we were addressing the actual issues behind it, my father's death being the huge catalyst behind all of this.
Right. I'm not familiar with that particular form of therapy. Can you talk about this a little bit? I've never heard of this.
Sure. So I'm going to try to describe it as best as I possibly can. I've only ever been a client or a patient for this type of thing. I've never actually gone to learn how to do it.
Okay.
So basically, it's for hidden trauma. And let's put it this way. A lot of people have had trauma in their lifetime and they know their story. It's just they may not know the full scope of how it's affecting them, or even like is currently affecting them in this day.
Right.
So the whole idea is to go back to those memories. And typically it's like a domino effect. Like, you may not necessarily understand how all the events are connected. So logically, it doesn't make a lot of sense. but emotionally it definitely does. Like, there typically is a common theme between all the events. So you go back to the earliest one, you reprocess that first, and then you go forward and you apply the same theme to the rest of them. And what it actually does, it releases the unhelpful wiring, let's say, in someone's brain.
Okay. Yeah, and we'll have a link to this in the show notes, definitely, because that sounds kind of interesting. That sounds relatively new. So you mentioned as well, and this was another one that I think ties in, the quote was, "I realized that when people talk about needing protection, deep down, what they're actually in need of protection from is themselves." And that one also kind of hit, thinking about people who are trying to get through something like what you were trying to process with the death of your father and not finding any way to really do that, not having necessarily a good outlet or any kind of outlet really for that feeling, for that grief. Do you find that that's pretty common with a lot of the people that you ran into, that there's just something that they don't want to process or can't process that is causing the rest of this?
Oh, absolutely. And it's a different story for everybody. So for myself, it's not just my father's death. It was also a struggle with my identity and sexuality. So I'm bi.
Okay.
And I actually only came out and admitted it to myself really when I was 25, but hey, better late than never.
Mm-hmm.
But I started noticing the feelings for both guys and girls when I was around 12 or 13, I want to say. And it was almost like a huge smack in the face when I was 14 and first starting high school. So this was, oh my God, this would have been around 2004. So it wasn't as accepted as it is now, let's say.
No.
So I remember if anyone had any inclination that you were gay or bi, it was like a one-way ticket to getting bullied at school. And that's exactly what happened to me.
Oh yeah.
And I can remember very vividly hiding out in the washroom several lunch periods just because I was afraid of like any comments that I would get in the hallways. So that's what I mean in the book by wanting to protect myself, because I wound up hating myself over something that I ultimately could not control.
Right. Something that you shouldn't have had to apologize for ever, but because of the way people treated this situation at the time, and, you know, in some cases still continue to treat it that way, you ended up getting, you know, bullied by, you know, small-minded, awful people as a result. I went to high school in the 90s. Just, yeah, they were totally fine with kids getting beat up. And it's kind of like their whole perspective on it in Eastern Washington at the time was just, well, don't be gay then. Yeah. So.
Yeah, that's just ridiculous. And I often say that, like, it really hasn't improved. It's just like bullying has changed its tune a lot. And if anything, I've heard that it's worse now. Like, especially the cyberbullying bit. Like, it's one thing to take a beating at recess, but it's quite another to have all your information and, like, any rumors that someone's made up about you online.
Oh, yeah, because it circulates. And once it's online, you don't know where it's going to go. You could go very, very, very viral, especially if there's video of you getting bullied, which in some cases exists. And then what happens from there? You end up being that kid that everybody's talking about. There's TikTok videos, there's reaction videos of you, and it's just, it's awful.
Yeah.
On a side note, there is a bill in the U.S. Congress right now to eliminate TikTok or force the parent company to sell it. And I really hope it passes. I really hope it passes.
I will keep my fingers crossed that. And actually, if you'd like to know how the bullying stopped.
Yeah, actually.
I was walking through one of the hallways. It was again in grade 9. I only took it for about a year or two before I did this. So I was kind of able to narrow down the two people who were spreading these rumors about me. One of them was a girl I sat beside in grade 9 English class who I did not particularly like in the first place.
Right.
So I saw her in the hallway one day. She had made some kind of snarky comment about me to someone else in front of me. So I said, you know what? To hell with this. I picked her up and put her in the garbage can.
You hate to encourage it, but man, if anyone had it coming.
You know, it's funny, man. Like, I only recently told my mother about that, and she's like, were you raised in a barn? And I'm like, well, in some ways, yours and dad's lessons about being the better person were not applicable. Like, they did not work.
Yeah. You turn the other cheek, and they smack you in that. What then?
Yeah. So, and I mean, looking back on it, the only problem that really came from that was I did get a little bit of a power trip out of that. And I always remembered that moment.
Right. And later on, when you were with the white nationalist crew, it seemed like they had you in an enforcer role. And you were one of the few people that was a woman and actually involved in it. You used the phrase skinbird, which I hadn't heard in quite some time. But you were actually out there kind of hanging out with the guys in the crew and doing all the same things that the guys did, where the girlfriends kind of hung back a little bit. It seems like you wanted to be viewed, you know, as a peer, as one of the guys, and they never quite got to that point where they would see you that way. Their whole trip was just never going to be to see a woman as somebody who was, you know, equal to what they were trying to do.
You know, it's interesting you bring this up. I had always wanted to be one of the guys when right. I was younger. I had some pretty bad experiences with other girls when I was in grade school in particular. They're not really worth getting into, but let's just say that they were bad experiences. So for me being that young, not being able to separate it and say, okay, well, everybody is an individual, I kind of developed like this really toxic attitude towards other women.
Right.
So what is this called again? Pick me girl. I was totally one of those.
Jeez. Yeah. And it seems to be like what you really wanted from the men in the movement wasn't even so much romantic or anything else. It was that you wanted to kind of be accepted as like a full member, a full partner in this whole thing. And they just wouldn't do it.
You know, with that first group that I was in that we're discussing right now, I wanted everything from them. And at that point, I had thought that I did. So I didn't date within like this very first group because, quite frankly, it fell apart pretty quickly because of our leader's toxic behavior, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as everything else, so I was put in the enforcer role. The guys did respect me at the time, or at least so I thought they did. So it was more or less validation I was looking for. And if a relationship came along at the time, I probably would have taken it.
And you mentioned this was the first group that you got into and it ended somewhat badly as you kind of got yourself pushed out. One girl decided that she was going to help push you out. You ended up getting beat up and they handled it about as awful as they possibly could. And from there, you had those people later come back and like apologize later on in the book. Like they realized that the person that had put them up to this and pushed them in this direction was pretty toxic himself and that they had all kind of been manipulated. Was it validating to hear them apologize like that?
I'm trying to remember back to that moment. I remember one girl. This is one of the ones that my ex-boyfriend had cheated on me with.
Okay.
And she had said, oh, I can see what you mean by he's abusive. And I said, well, I mean, I warned you, but I didn't expect to get listened to, of course. So she's profusely apologizing. And I kind of had to wonder at the time, like, what is she after with me? Like, what's her motivation to try to be nice to me or make friends with me again? Because she had also told me that her and him had split up the day previous. So was she trying to get back at him? Because, I mean, I'm right. not about that. I don't want to waste my energy on it, even at the time. But I remember her walking up to me in this drop-in center for homeless youth in Toronto called Evergreen. And she said, you were right.
Right, right. Now, after that, you ended up involved with a group that's a somewhat bigger presence in the white power scene and has been for a number of years. You were involved with the Hammerskins. What can you tell me about the way they work as opposed to some of these other crews? Because they seem to be at a whole different level of how they handle things.
Yeah, so for me, the first ever interaction with them was, well, the first interaction that's actually important is that first ever show that I had went to in the West End of Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
So what I can remember of that, I got the invite from someone who I had met at another function prior, and he was the one who typically did the organizing of these shows. So he told me to meet him out at Islington subway station in Toronto. So I go out there. He is not there himself, but I see somebody on the other side of the tracks who is dressed just like me, looks in my direction, nods and then keeps walking. So I said, what the hell was that?
Right.
So I'm not impressed with the organizer at this point. I give him a call and he's like, okay, so what you're going to do now is go back one subway station. So another freaking subway fare, which I was not happy about.
Right.
So you're going to go back to Royal York Station and then take the bus down to Evans Avenue. And like, you'll see the place and like, I'll meet you there and everything.
Oh, geez.
So, you know, I'm like, okay, I basically just went through a checkpoint. Mm. And at the time I could understand why they do that. But now, of course, I'm like, those are not the type of friends that I want in my life. Like, if I'm going to meet you somewhere, then we're meeting at like the first agreed spot.
Right. We're not doing this get in a car and blindfold yourself crap. Seriously.
Oh, God, no. No. That's just a recipe for disaster in my viewpoint.
Yeah, no, that's...
So I finally get to the show. I'm feeling better about everything. The rest of the night is kind of a blur. I probably spent most of it in the mosh pit or downing beers like a mad person.
And they had a different ethos about how they were presenting themselves. Like they were, it seems, more of the grow your hair out, look as normal as you can possibly look, get a straight job. And keep yourself in the movement, but don't be visible about that.
Yeah. So that's pretty much verbatim what I was told by several of the members at the time, that I did need to clean up my image, that I needed to dress differently, give up the combat boots. And they always brought up the word feminine with me. I'm sure you can tell by this point in the interview that I'm not really super into the hyper femininity thing.
A little.
Yeah, just a little bit. But at the time, frankly, I was willing to put on any mask for the purposes of acceptance. I didn't want to burn any more bridges at the time. So I grudgingly go along with that. And the whole idea about get a 9-to-5 job or like a regular job presents with a little bit of a cleaner image.
Right.
So we basically were writing the manual of how to be a better criminal one-on-one. So how to assimilate better so you can get away with more.
Right. And we've covered that strategy to an extent before on this show. We had Dr. Amanda Rogers. We were talking about a guy named Tom Metzger, who was the head of White Aryan Resistance in Fallbrook, California at one point. And that was Metzger's whole thing, was go normal looking, go clean. Don't do the shaved head. Don't do the flight jacket. Don't do the boots. Get a job. Go be a cop. Go be in the military. Go be someplace where when we have the race war, we can call you when we need you. And from what you said about the Hammerskins, it seems like they were kind of on that same mentality of let's get people into position so when the race war comes down, as they always seem to think it's going to any minute now, they would have their own troops kind of involved in that and ready to go. So how big is this group in Canada? How big are the Hammerskins up there in terms of, you know, are they in every province, or is it just an Ontario thing, do you think?
From my understanding, actually, they have faded off a little bit, although they are still around.
Right.
Nowadays, actually, several of them had gone over to ACC, Active Club Canada.
Oh, yeah. That's the new thing.
Which I know is getting to be a huge problem up here.
Yeah, it's a huge problem everywhere at this point. Active clubs, I don't want to go too far into detail about any of this because, you know, I don't want to give it the oxygen. But at the same time, it's groups getting together and sort of doing the hiking society, or we're just guys who like getting together and enjoying the outdoors and training, you know, martial arts or whatever. And in reality, what they're doing is they're doing their hate group stuff. They're just doing it a little bit more off the radar and trying to look cleaner when they do it.
Yeah. So that tactic has been around for the longest time. So have a front that does not look threatening at all.
Right.
And I even remember one of the Hammerskin guys, I'm not going to name drop, but so we'll say one of the guys had tried to open up his own boxing gym at one point, but the purpose of it behind the initial image was to recruit younger guys, kind of become their father figure and basically, you know, see what comes of it from there.
A lot of these guys kind of started walking into the Brazilian jiu-jitsu world a few years ago, and that's where I'm coming out of. So seeing this rhetoric start to show up around gyms was really disturbing because, you know where it comes from. You know who the people are that are saying it, and you're kind of like, wait a minute, what are you trying to do here? take your entryist bullshit somewhere else. We are not doing this. You are not around here if this is how you're going to talk about things. So what would you say the main catalyst in walking away from the Hammerskins was for you at that point? Because you mentioned a few things. You talk about your liver. You talk about cirrhosis. You talk about doctors basically saying, don't ever drink again. It's not going to be good. You mentioned frustration with the ex-boyfriend and the idea of kids. Was it just everything that kind of hit at once, or?
There's also a couple more things than that. So I feel like we need to get into this discussion more often, or I need to get into it more often, but burnout, it is a very real thing. So I remember that it hit me even before this whole string of events in 2012 had happened. So I was having a discussion with the boyfriend at the time, or ex-boyfriend now rather, and he was on about one of his anti-Semitic rants. And typically I would have been pretty engaged in this conversation, but this time I told him, listen, you need to tell me when I should care. So it's a very different reaction than I would have given him about a year prior. Because, you know, you get so sick of hearing all of this. And even then, like, if you look at the rhetoric, all it is rhetoric. It doesn't have, right, like, any backup to it.
Nobody's actually out doing anything. Everybody's just kind of talking. And yeah, that's funny. Tell me when I should care. Okay. I'm going to check out and think about something else for a few minutes. You just tell me when I should start paying attention again. Wow.
Exactly.
What was his response? How did he respond to that?
He was a little bit thrown off by that. He's like, what the fuck?
That would have been fun to see.
Oh, it was priceless. I wish I had that recorded. Like, I would show it to everybody. So anyways, following that, there was also the death of another member in the group. It was a murder.
Right.
So he had gotten himself involved in other criminal activity, let's say, and this was a result of the choices. And I remember the tribute show that we had put on for him after the fact. And they said, oh, this is for our fallen brother. He's like a martyr of our people. I'm just kind of trying to remember generally what they were saying on stage in his memory. But I was thinking, no, it was a result of poor choices.
Right.
Stop trying to victimize somebody who just wasn't a victim in the situation.
Yeah, because it sounded like he kind of got in with some gangster type of people and was doing some gangster things when he ended up getting killed. And that's terrible and tragic and whatnot, but they generally make a choice to be in that position. People do. So you feel bad that they didn't make better choices, but at the same time, this was avoidable. This didn't have to happen the way it happened.
Exactly. And I remember at that same show, I was already drunk, pissed off, like, right, fired up in order to say something like this. But I can remember one of the guys going on this huge anti-immigrant rant, and he was also struggling to find employment at the time.
Right.
So I eventually said to him, hey man, did you ever think that this is a you problem? I did not get a good reaction from that one. But I mean, you know what? That comes from a place of critical thinking, I believe, because you take a look at the guy. You see the outer facade and attitude that he has. No employer is going to look at that as management material.
No. And that's true for a lot of these people. It really is. It's not the immigrants that are keeping you from getting jobs. It's the attitude. It's the look. It's the way you go through the world. It really is. But it's hard for people to see that, especially when they're the person that, you know, would have to take a hard look in the mirror and have that conversation with themselves. It's really hard for anyone to do that, really. And these aren't people that have a whole ton of self-awareness.
Oh, gosh, no.
Kind of shifting gears a little bit here. You wrote a really excellent article for the Globe and Mail about Charlottesville and the death of Heather Heyer. And we will go ahead and link to that in the show notes. And one point that you touch on that I think bears repeating is when you said specific incidents may be attributed to lone wolves, but they are supported and encouraged by a culture of hate that transcends borders. And we've been talking lately on this podcast a whole lot about the idea of lone wolves and how it's actually a deliberate strategy designed to immunize the leaders of these groups from any legal consequences. So do they have as hard a time going after the leadership in Canada as they do down here in the States?
Absolutely. The thing is, it's always the people in like the lower ranks right, that get tasked with all the dirty work. And they're also the same ones that do jail time for it.
Right.
So definitely, I believe that it is frustrating for everybody up here too, to see this.
Right. Like, you know who's pulling the trigger, you know who the shot callers are, but you don't have any real good way of making sure that those people stop doing what they're doing. That's just insanely frustrating. And that strategy seems to be really good for not only keeping them out of trouble, but also from keeping, you know, media people and the credulous folks that cover this in a lot of cases from looking at it and going, boy, there certainly are a whole lot of lone wolves doing a whole lot of lone wolf thing. You think maybe some of these lone wolves might be talking to each other a little bit before they go and do any of this stuff?
You know what? I'm actually not really super fond of the term lone wolf because none of them technically were acting alone.
No.
Or at least that's my viewpoint. The thing is, like, all of them have taken inspiration from others who have done this before.
Yeah, and this is a very definitely a strategy that, you know, I mean, we talked about this on several episodes, including one with Jacob Ware not too long ago, where we talked about a guy named Louis Beam, who was at one point a KKK leader down in Texas. He was with the Aryan Nations. He was with the Order. This guy is next to practically every white power thing that happened in the 80s and 90s. He's like standing just right there. Not to a point where he's necessarily criminally culpable, although they did try to charge him with seditious conspiracy in 1987 in Fort Smith, Arkansas, which, you know, they all beat that rap. But that was the part where he said, we can't ever get together in big numbers because they're going to do this. From now on, we're going to do leaderless resistance. We're going to have people out doing this stuff and everybody knows what the goal is, but we're going to pretend it's all individuals. He was very explicit about this. He wrote this all up. And it's disturbing to see that that strategy just worked so well and continues to work very well to this day. Because everybody can disavow the individual, but they can be like, well, you know, I mean, if we weren't letting all these immigrants into the country, he wouldn't be so angry. They can do that. And it's just frustrating as hell. It's like, no, this is a plan. You guys are doing this on purpose.
Yeah, the whole idea of leaderless resistance, it's very hard for people to kind of envision what it may look like, particularly for law enforcement. I've heard this several times too.
Right.
Because what we're kind of used to when we think about gangs is like some kind of hierarchy. So to hear about something that is in operation that is dangerous but does not have that is a lot harder to figure out.
Well, I would postulate part of it is that the average gang isn't necessarily motivated by ideology. The average gang is motivated by money more than almost anything else. Making money, doing activities that make you money. The whole goal is getting money. And a lot of these extremist groups are not necessarily primarily money motivated. Sometimes they do things, you know, illegal to get money, but they're motivated more by a cause than any financial gain that they could possibly make. Like, I mean, the Order, for example, they started by robbing armored cars in the Seattle and Spokane area. And that money went into things like, we're going to help these people buy a bigger compound. We're going to help buy Commodore 64 computers and pass them out to all of these other Nazis. And then we're going to set up a bulletin board system so these people can all talk to each other. And the feds can't listen because they don't know how to get into this. This is the kind of stuff they were doing with the proceeds. They're not buying, you know, baller cars necessarily. They're figuring out how to pour this money back into the movement. So I think that the idea that this wouldn't work in a traditional gang setting. You couldn't do this because the goal is money and the goal is, you know, needing to have somebody top down telling you how to do this kind of stuff. But if there's an ideology involved, everybody knows what they're supposedly pointing at. Everybody knows what you're supposed to be looking for, which is like, you know, the propagation of the white race or getting rid of all the immigrants or, you know, this is getting rid of the Jews. This is their goal that they're looking to. And you don't necessarily need a leader to tell you specifically how to do that. You just have to come up with an idea that'll get you in that direction and go do it.
Exactly.
I think that's where the disconnect is. They're looking for somebody that's handing out the orders and there just doesn't need to be one.
Yeah. And like I said, we're kind of used to like that hierarchy structure within a gang. So to see it not used for this is a little bit different.
Right.
So I do believe that we need to get our minds out of that whole idea of trying to figure out the hierarchy or structure and just look at the behavior.
Right. Because it doesn't really matter to some extent who the hierarchy and the structure is. It doesn't. Somebody else will step up when that happens. So after you got out, you did kind of normal stuff for a while. You worked at a couple of cabinet shops. You worked in some construction for a while. And you mentioned that in 2017, when you heard about Charlottesville and you looked into what that was, that really spurred you to start figuring out a way to contribute more to ending this kind of hate and violence. How did you get from that point to where you are now in terms of helping people get out of these groups?
So thanks to one of my friends from high school who never cut contact or gave up on me, he had sent me the link for Life After Hate and said, hey, this seems right up your alley. You should totally reach out and, you know, see if they have anything for you to do. So I said, that is actually a very good idea. I'll do that. So my first point of contact was actually Brad Galloway, and I recognized his voice once we got on the phone. We were actually part of rivaling groups when we were younger. We're friends now, but yeah, I consider that to be healing. It's a positive thing when that happens.
Right.
And things kind of took off from there. So I started off by doing public speaking and media engagement. And it's interesting, at that time, around 2017 or 2018, I never could have seen myself doing the direct service work, because I often questioned, like, okay, I am like currently a blue collar construction worker. Do I really have the patience or the composure to do a job like this? Mm-hmm. But several of my coworkers who knew where I was volunteering at the time and who knew a little bit about my past had said, well, have you ever noticed that literally all of us come up to you when we're having a rough day or just need someone to vent off to? You handle us fine.
Right.
So I said, well, I mean, you know, that is kind of true. He did bring up a good point.
Plus, you would think that your background, you know, working in the trades gives people a lot of the time their working jobs kind of like that. Do you find that that helps you relate to some of what you run into?
Oh, yeah, I would think so. I've had several clients come through that work in construction or have before. So whenever they're venting off about their day, I'm like, yep, I've been there. I've done that.
Right. So what do you look to see when somebody's in the exit process? And I'm sure there's that sort of sense of they kind of want to run before they can walk a lot of the time, in terms of how far out they are and how removed they are from the process. What do you kind of look at to assess how far out somebody might be, regardless of what they kind of say in public?
For me, actually, I'm very much a bigger picture type of person. So what I'm going to look at is, all right, well, what are you trying to communicate to me? And like, how are you talking about your past? Does it still sound like you're proud of it? And, you know, I've had several people come through after like reading my story online and telling me, oh, I was in deeper than you. And I'm like, well, good job. How are we getting you out of this, though?
Yeah, because it doesn't need to turn into a pissing contest about who's been hanging out with worse people or who did worse stuff. The goal is getting people out.
Exactly.
So you're saying kind of if they still kind of glamorize it to some extent and think, oh man, those were the days.
Well, simply put, if I sense the conversation turning into a giant dick measuring contest, that will tell me quite a lot.
Right. So you've been doing this since about, you said, I think 2021 when we talked, you were starting to do the direct, like bringing people out.
So I'm trying to remember timing right now. So 2020 is when I joined the exit team. I was only doing it part-time.
Right.
And I was also still working my day job when I did scaffolding. So I did both of those things for about a year. Plus my mother and I were also writing the book at the time. So you can imagine I didn't get a lot of sleep during that year.
No, definitely not.
But you know what? The end results of it were good. 2021 is when I quit the job in scaffolding and just switched over to doing this full time.
Right.
And the book was also published just after the new year as well.
Okay. So one other thing that was really interesting that came out of the book was you talk about preventative actions. And one of the things that you say is the preventative actions might not have saved me when I was first getting into the movement, but I might have benefited from a nudge in those moments where the little voice in my head had argued, this isn't right. It's been a healthy journey for me because I've had to pour over all the negative shit that I used to radicalize myself. Before all of these exercises, I had never realized how often I'd done what every racist does, make exception. If I were out of sync with the subculture somehow, I would decide I'm going to do this anyway. I just won't tell any of my friends. And I think you really hit on something important when you talk about out of sync, because you're right. Everybody does this. You don't necessarily have to be a racist, but everybody believes things, I think, and then has their own sort of exceptions for that. But I think it can be really helpful when somebody is trying to think of whether they should leave a movement like this to kind of point out some of those contradictions, because that will eat at you if you're living in a manner where, like, there's something that's a part of your life that is not congruent with your ethics or not congruent with what you claim to believe. So this was from your mom's part of the book. And this is really interesting because this is a very nuanced subject, but I asked Lauren recently if taking the internet away would have prevented her from becoming involved in the movement. It would have reinforced my theories of mind control and the ideology of mind crimes, where one is not allowed to think a certain way, she replied. If you'd kept me off white power sites or away from the group, I'd have gone further underground. The way I see it, she continued with a shrug, keeping troubled people from accessing information just pushes them into terror cells. That's how you get that 1 in 100 person who carries out mass shootings or killings. So you mentioned that your views are pretty nuanced on this one. And I guess my question would be, how do you stop the people that are the propagandists for this without necessarily making the kids feel like they're being kept away from something that they want to know about?
So for me, actually, I should start off with the idea of open dialogue. It wasn't something that was ever encouraged in my household growing up, not around any of my family members, and even at school, because I ran into this several times with a couple of my teachers where I would hand in reports or essays. And because my opinion was different than theirs, I got a failing grade for it. Yeah. So my thing is, like, if someone has problematic views, it's worth figuring out, like, where they learned it and what's actually behind it, other than just shaming them in front of class or sweeping it under the rug, hoping it goes away, such as what was done in my case.
So having that conversation, being able to figure out where this came from, get to the source of that belief, and then let's look at that source. Like being able to maybe sit down with the kid and say, you're reading this book that's written by this guy that says that the Holocaust didn't happen because this and that and the other. Let's see if we can prove any of this or disprove any of this. And let's look at who wrote it. Let's see what this person's about. So, like, kind of analyzing the claims and going through what they were saying, you think that would have probably helped you?
So definitely starting off the conversation by saying, so listen, I'm a little bit concerned about something that you had handed in or something that you had said in class. Now, as far as opening up the conversation, this is a lot easier said than done, even for me, I admit, is not to get defensive or argumentative in any way. So in other words, keep your ego out of the conversation.
Right.
Because what you actually want to try to get them to open up about is, like, whatever's going on in their personal life. So, like, you need to see that vulnerability in order to actually achieve anything.
Right. Right. And if they don't trust you, if they don't feel like you're an honest broker, as it were, they're not going to tell you about any of that.
Exactly. And this is also why I tell people, you know, as much as I'm for compassion, I'm also for straightforwardness. Mm-hmm. You may as well just say exactly what you're thinking to whoever you're speaking with so that they know, okay, like, this is what the conversation is for. Like, don't try to be deceptive in any way. And it actually brings me back to the time when I was in the UK with my family around 2016. I had gone out for a smoke break. We were at the Art Museum downtown London. So I went out for a cigarette and I was approached by a guy who was dressed exactly the same way as I used to dress. So combat boots, suspenders, an Iron Eagle t-shirt, and just like the whole nine yards. So he had asked me for a cigarette and I said, yeah, sure. We got into a conversation. He had said, I noticed you got an accent. So I said, do I? Because to me, the rest of you have it. But okay, whatever, I'm Canadian. So he's like, oh, Kanatistan. So this is something that I had heard when I was in those circles. And eventually I had to stop him. And I said, hey, listen, I used to buy into the same things as you once did. If you take a look at the side of my neck, you'll notice a tattoo there that was laser removed. You can still see some of the scarring from it. So I said, look, I don't hold anger or any resentment towards you all. I can tell that you can do better. just as I did. So I hope that happens for you someday. And I left him a little bit speechless. I would have carried on the conversation a little bit more, except I noticed my mom and brother coming outside and I didn't need to hear it from Mother Dearest. I thought we were over this. Why are you talking to him? Me.
So I take it she's still a little bit protective of this whole situation, kind of a little bit involved in it.
Well, in 2016, she definitely was. I think it's that she didn't want me to bring home another wounded bird, so to speak, so she puts it. And I mean, realistically, what are the chances of me bringing over a guy from England?
Yeah.
Like, even though I was single at the time, I wasn't like that desperate.
Right. He'd have had to really have something going, and doesn't sound like this guy did.
No, I mean, nice enough gentleman and everything, but too old for me, not really my type.
So, in your opinion, what are the most important things that a parent can do if they find themselves in this situation?
I would definitely say to reach out. And the reason I say that is because I find far too many parents don't speak out or become vulnerable about just whatever's going on within their family, especially their kids. Right. And my mom will tell you this. There is a culture of shame around parenting. Where, like, how dare you make a mistake? How dare you not be the perfect parent? Like, there's so much pressure on people with kids. And even as someone without them, I see it. I can understand that.
Yeah. You can't make mistakes and you're going to get blamed for anything the kids do. So you have to absolutely be hard on the kids and make sure they don't ever make a mistake because it's your fault if they did it. So reaching out and looking for that support. Yeah, definitely. That's important.
And also, for most cases, not to blame themselves. I find this in particular with mothers, actually.
Right.
Not that it doesn't go the same for fathers, but I've noticed it more with moms where they'll blame themselves for everything that goes wrong in the family.
Mm. Yeah, that's kind of a symptom of what we've trained women to believe, right? I mean, the idea that everything is kind of your fault and you are responsible for everything and you have to make sure everything actually works. And if it doesn't, it's probably something you did wrong. So that makes sense.
Yeah. And actually, one thing on that note that I'm thankful for is my parents had never told me that it's my job to fix anybody. They told me it's not my problem.
That must have been probably pretty helpful at some point, especially with these people.
Yeah.
So how's life going for you now?
Pretty boring, but I say that in a positive sense.
Right.
So for me, I have like the whole day-to-day routine of working at home, talking with clients, doing staff meetings. For weekends, mine aren't really filled with too much right now, just because like we're still getting out of the colder months.
Right.
But come summertime, I'm definitely going skydiving again. I've already done that twice now.
And that's fun. You enjoy that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's quite the rush. Yeah, so I did used to do abstract painting in my spare time. I really need to get back into it. The only thing I found is it is kind of an expensive hobby or the style I like to do anyways.
Right.
So we'll get to that when we get to that. And definitely tattoos, body modifications, piercing of any kind. It's another good form of self-care.
Right. You mentioned in the book that you played music for a while. Do you still?
So yes, I still have my bass from when I was 14. That thing has literally seen everything, including what was inside the movement. This is also the same one as I used when I was in the music scene myself.
Right.
So not in a band currently, just because I don't really have the time for that. Although given the time, I would like to be again someday.
What kind of stuff would you play?
So for me, I am still a metalhead. As much as people told me when I was younger and first getting into it that it was just a phase, they were wrong because I'm 33 now. And of course, I'm assuming that it's going to stick around for quite a few more years.
Right.
But at the same time, I've also opened up like my music selection quite a bit. So I used to be just metal and now it's pretty much anything. Like whenever anyone asks me, oh, what kind of music do you like? And I'm like, I don't know, whatever sounds good.
Yeah, it's about the best answer because there's so much good stuff going on out there. And if you lock yourself into like one genre or I only listen to this, you'll never hear it. So what can people do to support you and the work that you're doing?
For me, I would actually say just educate yourself as much as possible. There are books and resources out there.
Right.
Because I've always said, knowledge is liberation. Typically, people say knowledge is power, but I actually prefer the term liberation nowadays. I just feel like it's more fitting.
If somebody might be listening to this that is potentially involved in something like this and might be struggling with it, we talked about this a little bit with Katie when we had her on the show, Katie McHugh, and she threw out a shout out to you guys as well, saying that, you know, Life After Hate is the the place to go talk to. So I kind of want to reiterate that if you are involved in this, and I know at least a few people who hate listen to this once in a while are, and you're thinking about going and doing something else for a while, maybe this isn't working for you, these seem to be the people that you want to go talk to. And what's the website address?
So it's lifeafterhate.org.
Okay. Yeah. They seem to be the people that can help you move past this whole thing. So if that's you, give it a try. Talk to them. Life's too short, you know? Lauren, thank you very much for coming on today. Really appreciate your time. Really appreciate you talking to me. This was fun, and I'm glad I got to talk to you. You're a pretty amazing person, and it'd be amazing to see what you do next with things.
Well, thank you for having me on. You almost made me blush there. Good job.
Oh, no, I mean, it's true. You've gone through a lot, and you've come out the other side, and a lot of people don't, and that's impressive. You should congratulate yourself for being able to, you know, course correct on some things that a lot of people just don't figure out. Because, I mean, we've both seen people not make it when it comes to this. And the fact that you did is absolutely admirable. And the fact that you're turning around and, you know, figuring out how to help other people instead of just, well, I got out, you know, that's cool. I'm going to go off and live my life and hopefully nothing bad ever happens to me again. But you've turned around and you've helped other people get past this horrible thing. So yeah, that's pretty impressive. I'm pretty impressed by that. So,
well, thank you.
Thank you for talking to me about it. Really appreciate your time today, and you have a great rest of your day. Okay.
Thanks. You too.
Thanks for listening to the Did Nothing Wrong podcast. If you want to hear more, you can find us on the web at didnothingwrongpod.com. Please make sure you subscribe to get our content straight into your inbox. You can also follow us on Twitter at GrizzaBJJ, GrzaBJJ, as well as DNWPod. We're extremely grateful for paid subscriptions and donations that allow us to keep doing this important work. Thanks, and remember, everyone mentioned did nothing wrong.